Maiden voyage here for the Hollinger and Duncan NBA show. I'm Nate Duncan, joined by John Hollinger, fresh off a 7-year stint with the Memphis Grizzlies. You probably already listened to our trailer, so we don't need to tell you why you should listen to the show. We're going to show you right now by having some awesome NBA discussion. And where John and I wanted to start here is first by him saying hello.
What's up, Nate? This is very excited.
He's been all over the world scouting for the last 7 years. We've seen some of these rookies now in preseason. And so we want to talk about just some thoughts on some of the rookies that John has a specific opinion about. I've got some as well to chime in, maybe see where our opinions differ from some of the consensus that's out there. So who's really stuck out to you? Who do you want to talk about first?
The guy who really sticks out to me, I mean, I'm going to stay away from the Captain Obvious category, so I'm not going to talk about Zion Williamson right now. But I will talk about a New Orleans Pelican, and that's Nickeil Alexander-Walker, because I never understood why he slipped as far as he did in the draft when there were so many question marks about this class. And he didn't have that sexy ceiling of some of these other guys. He doesn't have freakish athletic pop. He doesn't make plays above the rim. He doesn't have super duper explosive burst off the dribble. But if you go through and check the boxes for what you want in an NBA guard, does he have size? Yes. Does he have length? Yes. Can he handle the ball? Yes. Can he pass? Yes. He's actually a great passer, especially with his left hand. Yeah, can he shoot? Good. Yes. Can he defend the position? Yes. There was like zero chance that this guy was going to fail, right? And in a draft with so many question marks and at a position where the league really struggles to find quality, I just couldn't believe that this guy wasn't a lottery pick given those parameters. I was a big fan of his, even though he made a horrible school choice and should have gone to Virginia and not Virginia Tech. clearly, he'd be a much wiser man for it right now.
Yeah,
of course.
He could have, if he'd gone to Virginia, he could have had all of his per game stats reduced by about 33% by the slow pace. He'd really screwed up by not going there.
He'd have a ring too, Nate. or whatever they give you for winning in the NCAA. Crack.
Well, we can be assured it's nothing of any monetary value. That's for sure. Yeah, John for enough. Those of you who don't know, went to Virginia, by the way. And sadly, I'm insulated from any sort of jokes at my school's expense at Tulane, because I think we were like 2-18 in conference last year or something like that. We might have even been like 0-18. So, but Mike Dunleavy did not exactly cover the school in glory after leaving the Clippers. But anyway, back to Nickeil.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wait, I didn't know this. You didn't ask me, you know. I saw Melvin Frazier play the other day, and you didn't even ask me for a scouting report. I didn't realize this.
I'm well aware of the scouting report on Melvin Frazier. Okay, but back to Nickeil. And I think it's fitting that he's like the first person that we're ever discussing on this show too. But I would totally agree with you. I mean, I fell in love with him back when he almost single-handedly engineered an upset of USA for Canada in the U18 tournament of the Americas. He looked great at the Hoop Summit. But the thing that is so interesting to me, I mean, you said, you know, he's not a sexy pick, and I agreed with you, right? I thought, you know, 3-and-D, can do a little ball handling ability, but more, he can shoot it, he competes, he's a smart player, good character. But what's really surprised me about him is he's really like, he's got some magic with the ball in his hands and some confidence. I mean, we saw it in summer league, these step back threes, some of the flair he's been passing with.
That step back three was a new thing. I saw when I saw him do that in summer league, I about fell out of my chair, because he did not show that at Virginia Tech in any of the games I saw.
Right. That's what
big sidestepped into the three pointer. That was like, whoa, okay, where'd this come from?
Yeah. Because I mean, I thought of him as more kind of like a caretaker. In fact, the book was that he had struggled when he had to play point guard. And he looks like really a pure point guard. And just the amount of flair and confidence that he's playing with has been a revelation for me, just from an aesthetic standpoint as well. But so, I mean, I to talk about this year, though, is he going to play?
It's going to be hard, but I think he's going to get in there. I mean, New Orleans has a lot of guards, and they have a good team, both of which will work against him. But I just can't imagine keeping him off the floor so that I could play Etuan Moore or Frank Jackson. Like, I just – that would be my, I've seen NBA teams do stuff like this, so I know that it's possible, but it would still boggle my mind if it actually happened.
Yeah, I mean, it happens a lot, and maybe there's a feeling like, oh, the season is starting. I mean, he started preseason well behind those guys, not even playing until the second half. It seems like he's looked so good, and even Jrue Holiday was. It's always interesting to hear in camp, and we're going to talk later about some of these roster decisions at the end of the roster, but to see who are the veterans kind of praising and not praising. And Jrue made sure to say, oh, Frank's been pretty good, but oh, Nikhil Alexander-Walker might be my favorite guy on the team. And so always interesting when the players start lobbying for someone like that.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a thing that definitely happens. Veteran players will start lobbying for certain guys, especially if there's a roster situation. It's really interesting how that played out on the inside in a couple of situations, we were in. So that's a piece of it.
Did you listen
but
to
then, him? I would say we took their input into account, but we probably went in the direction we were going to go anyway on those decisions. But it is interesting. Yeah. I always tried to listen to them, especially the players that I knew were higher IQ, because the one thing we couldn't replicate in the front office was the experience of being on the court with those guys. So a lot of times they could tell you right away, this guy knows how to play, this guy doesn't know how to play, off a very small sample of possessions, just because they could, because they were out there in the mix with them, they could just feel things that we couldn't feel or see.
So would that be like, oh, the guy's missing defensive assignments, he doesn't know where to be, or is it like, this guy was guarding me and he just couldn't stop me, he had no chance against me? Would they ever be specific about the kind of comments?
They would just intuit how a guy feels and reads the game very quickly, especially a couple of our veteran players. They could just figure it out almost immediately. Like, that they'd just be like, well, that guy doesn't know how to play, and it'd be like, what do you mean? And they'd be, well, there was this situation, he did this, and that was ridiculous. And it would be hard. Like, even if you'd have to watch it back a couple times, maybe the practice film, and be like, oh yeah, I guess he had a point there. So that was really interesting to me because of how quickly they would catch on to how well certain players could think or not think the game.
Were they ever wrong ultimately, or were they actually seeing it before you guys could?
I think they were seeing it before we could most of the time. But obviously they were seeing a static point in time though, as opposed to a progression of where a player might end up. And that was where, you know, that was where our expertise had to come in, having seen the guys, you know, progress through college or Europe or whatever, and to the point they were, and try to ascertain where they were heading. Because that's what you really do. I mean, the NBA in the front office, you're essentially working in a futures market, right? So you're trying to, part of that is evaluating what a player can do right now. But the biggest part is evaluating what is the player going to do for the time period you have him under contract.
Yeah. And I think like players and coaches, maybe players even more than coaches, are so focused on the now, or focused on what a guy did last year. I mean, it definitely seems like, just anecdotally looking at it from afar, that most of the situations where it's like, oh yeah, the players really wanted this guy on the team, like, it doesn't really seem to work out that well.
I would say that is true.
All right. Well, we've got the rest of our lives to get into these kind of stories. So I agree with you on Nikhil. Yeah, go ahead.
There is one point here, though, on Nikhil Alexander-Walker, because one of the tools a front office has at its disposal is to shape the roster in such a way that it's unavoidable to play a certain player. In other words, if you don't like the fact that Frank Jackson is taking his minutes, you do have the option of trading Frank Jackson or doing something else with Frank Jackson. That is a resource you have at your disposal on the front office side. It's not something that you should use cavalierly, but in certain situations, it could be a tool that you feel the need to use.
As you said, it is unavoidable. I had this view of you sitting in front of JB Bickerstaff at the start of last year, wearing like the Emperor's robes from Return of the Jedi, and saying, it is unavoidable. It is your destiny. You will play Dylan Brooks this year.
Dylan, unfortunately, set the world record for freak injuries in one season. I mean, the play where he stepped on the basketball, like, you couldn't do that a million times in a million tries.
Lamar Odom did that once, actually, and sprained his ankle, like, back 15 years ago, I think.
Well, now you've ruined my entire premise, because it's two in a million now.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you're supposed to be the numbers guy.
I'm supposed to be the numbers guy. I was off by a factor of 100%.
All right. So, yeah, Nikhil, I mean, I agree. I think he's going to be good. You know, we'll see. I mean, sometimes there are guys who just have this start that looks really good and look great in preseason when nobody's trying. And, you know, you do wonder about whether he can be efficient because he's not amazing getting to the basket. And they also have these other on-ball guys. He still is a little slight. But, yeah, I mean, I love him as a long-term prospect. And I think, you know, certainly to me, I would rather play him, especially considering New Orleans' future, than Josh Hart or Etuan Moore at this point, even though I that's not to disrespect those guys. I think those guys are actually underrated players, perhaps in their own right at times. So Ja Morant is someone that I think, you know, he's the number two overall pick, right? I mean, he was known for his highlights at Murray State. I mean, I think this guy, from what I've seen from him in the preseason against like the one game against actual NBA competition, they haven't had the hardest schedule in the world, and he sat out against OKC last night. But I think he's already the best offensive player on the Grizzlies. I think that he actually is really going to help them. Granted, from a low floor, they don't have a ton of offensive talent on the team right now. But like, that guy is just magic. Like, I think people are just not seeing what a special ball handler and passer he is, like, to the point where I'd put him maybe above just about any point guard prospect I've seen in the last like 10 years in those regards. Do you agree with me, or do you not see him quite that way?
So I probably agree with you. I mean, it's hard because I'm so close to it. Like, hard for me to pull myself away from it. I mean, obviously you see some of these passes he makes them with either hand. And scouting Murray State last year, you know, when you watch them in person, you really realized how bad the rest of that team was and how much Ja Morant was carrying that offense and making these other guys look a lot better than they were. And when you saw, like, against Belmont, when he hurt his ankle, just him being out for 2 minutes, it was virtually impossible for them to score against a fringe NCAA tournament team. Like, they had no chance at all. And even, you know, Ja was playing on a bad ankle the rest of the game, and so they lost or whatever. But just having him out there to make those reads and those plays just opened so many other things up that weren't ever going to be there otherwise. And the other thing that I think has really impressed me is that even in the first half of last season, he would make those wow passes, but he was pretty wild too. And he's really toned a lot of that down, it seems to me, and gotten a lot more control over his decision making and sort of that fine tuning of, okay, this has a 20% chance to be amazing and a 40% chance to end up in the eighth row. So maybe I won't throw this pass, you know? So, I was impressed with that, and we'll see if that degree of control is able to follow him into the season or not, because obviously they played two garbage teams those first two games, and he's only played one kind of real exhibition game.
Yeah, and they also played against Charlotte in that game. Although Charlotte's
defense and they lost by 90, so I mean, Charlotte was good for whatever reason.
But yeah, I mean, and they also have limited other threats on the team as well. So he's going to have to create a lot. I mean, I could see him being up in the league leaders in turnover percentage among some of the high usage guards. But who else sticks out to you from this class, either for good or for ill, that might be different than what kind of the national expectations are for?
Well, I have an information advantage on this guy. So I want to talk about Goga Bitadze. Player I've seen overseas a couple of times. Thought he went a little low. Thought he probably should have been the first international player selected. Not counting Rui Hachimura as an international player, since
you liked him better than Siku.
Yes. Yeah. When I watch Goga play, one of the things you're looking at when you scout is not just strengths and weaknesses, but how fixable are the weaknesses and how prominent are the strengths, and how much of a factor can the strengths be in an NBA game? You look at a 7-footer with 3-point shooting ability, decent bounciness, not amazing, not going to be poster dunking guys, but good, good enough. And then you look, okay, what are his weaknesses? Well, his weaknesses are things like strength, lower body leverage. A lot of times he can get beasted inside. Those things are all fixable as guys get older, their bodies develop. You get him an NBA strength program. You maybe wish his hands were a little bit better, but you're really nitpicking there. He's not a freak athlete, but a lot of 7-footers aren't in this league. If you're skilled and you know how to play, and you're usually going to have a chance. And then the other thing that stands out about him, he has a passion for the game. He's not somebody who just plays because he's tall. And I've always felt with guys like that, when they have that drive within them and they're big and they're skilled, the fail rate is going to be really low on guys like that. So I was encouraged to see he finally played in his first preseason game yesterday. I didn't watch the game, so he had pretty good numbers. But I like him. I do think he's going to need to spend some time bulking up before he can really handle the physicality of playing every day in the NBA. I wouldn't be surprised to see him in Fort Wayne a lot. But I think he's a pretty good long-term prospect. Now, it's a little different these days because you're talking about in an NBA draft and you're picking a 5. Well, yeah. One of the reasons he slipped probably is just because the league has devalued 5s so much. But I think he's a good player with the right background to develop all the talent he has.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of like, he's a center. They already have a bunch of centers. What are they doing? You know, I mean, obviously, again, though, like you pick someone at 18 and he's a rotation player, like you probably did pretty good there, right? Like, I mean, that's what it boils down to, regardless of what position they play. And I don't know that there's anyone incredibly sexy that was going to change their destiny behind them. I mean, we'll see if like Thybul or Clark or yeah. Grant Williams, I guess. Yeah, I mean,
those guys would be their road not taken, right?
Yeah, yeah. But and also, I mean, if you can always play the game. Oh, they picked this guy at 18, and there's 3 guys who went in the next 10 picks that were better than him. I mean, to say, yeah, we're going to pick the absolute best guy on the board at 18 out of everyone remaining.
Thank you. That thing always bothered me, and it bothered me more when I got on the front office side, obviously. But when people said, well, this pick after you turned out to be awesome. Well, yeah, if the entire field is probably going to outperform our pick. Right?
I can't think of a situation where Memphis took a player and then someone else was picked right afterwards, and the media was killing you guys for picking that player afterwards.
You know what's so funny?
It doesn't come to mind.
And it wasn't Nikola Jokic. It was the other pick. That is the thing that will never stop killing me.
Yeah, that they're killing you guys for Rodney Hood.
The thing that I beat my head against the wall over for the last 5 years is that we took Jarnell Stokes over Nikola Jokic. And, that maybe, you know, what could I have done? Should I have, evaluated things differently or pushed things in a different direction? What could have happened differently to make that not our pick? You know, that, because that is the one move that I think would have potentially changed things a lot. All the other stuff probably would have led to roughly the same place.
Yeah. And, well, if it makes you feel better, I was saying the same thing about Jokic. I'm like, how does he have the athleticism to survive on the interior?
Everybody had the question. People didn't know of it. People were questioning his passion for the game. People were questioning his conditioning. But I got to say, he had a disappointing hoop summit, but I went out to Serbia to scout him between the hoop summit and the draft. Man, he was doing stuff that he does with the Nuggets now. Like, I just beat my head over this every day. He pulled up from half court and just shot a jump shot and drew nothing but net at the end of a half one game.
Yeah.
I was like, did I just see that? Did I just see this 7-foot, probably like 285-pound guy at the time just pull up and rain one like that? So in retrospect, like, I beat my head against the wall over that more than anything that probably happened in the entire time I was there. Because that was the real potential difference-making move.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you guys had this dude, Marc Gasol, right? Like, it was and now a second-round pick isn't necessarily going to change things in terms of, like, drafting.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't stop us from drafting a 5 every other year. So, I mean, I should have, you know, it probably that would have been the one to pick, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and like, I was in the same boat as you, like, last year or something. Like, someone who works for, like, the Denver Nuggets social team combed through my evaluation of Jokic of Basketball Insiders after that hoop summit and was like, and quoted it and like, you know, tried to make it look out like an idiot. I'm like, calm down. You guys took him 40. Like, you know, you didn't think he was going to be this good.
I believe they took multiple players before him, if I remember right from that draft. They definitely took Gary Harris before him. I'm trying to remember if they took someone else in there too.
Oh, yeah. Nurkic too. Yeah, that would have been they 16 and 19. Nurkic, yeah. And then they didn't even bring him over for a year or two, right? It wasn't his rookie year, 2015, so...
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, I mean, and you know, the Warriors took Harrison Barnes and Festus Ezeli before Draymond Green too. I mean, there's a lot of those instances. So you're never going to bat even 800, not to mention a thousand. So anyway, now that we're 23 minutes in and we've discussed three players, who should be the fourth? yeah, this is a lot of pressure here. You got to find one other person. This is our last chance. Let me ask you this: Who do you think is a little overrated in this class?
A little overrated in this class,
as far as where they went in terms of in the draft.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Cameron Johnson is the easy one, right?
Yeah,
that might be a little too fish in a barrel for our audience.
I don't know. I mean, he's like. If he's 6'9" and he can shoot, though,
he can shoot. He's 23. Yeah. Like, he was a backup at Pitt when all these other guys who came out in the lottery are 19, 20, and were among the best players in their college teams. And Cameron Johnson, when he was their age, was a backup at Pitt, right?
Yeah.
And not Duke, you know, Pitt.
what got him drafted.
There were some questions about his hip, which we on this side do not have access to that medical information that they get out of the combine, but there were definitely murmurs about that. I also think his senior year or his fifth year actually was probably a little bit of an outlier from a shooting perspective. Like, he can shoot, but is he really a 45% 3-point shooter? Like, had he ever shown that capability before? So I question that, and I just think there was still high-level talent on the board. Even if you know, obviously I talked about Nikhil Alexander-Walker, but like PJ Washington, Tyler Herro, like those guys are going to be good players. And those are the two picks right after him. I would feel much better if I'm Phoenix if I had one of those two guys.
Well, I don't know if you heard, they're taking a big step forward this year, though. I don't know that Johnson is going to be bad. I mean, 6'9", if he's really got the jump shot and he could be, you know, even remotely passable defensively, like he actually could be a decent player. But to me, so much of these draft picks and people are like, oh, well, why do you overvalue these first round picks? Like, most of them don't work out. For me, it's more about just, well, you at least have some chance of getting a guy who's really going to be a difference maker for your franchise. And I even if Johnson becomes a decent player, I'd be hard pressed to believe he could be a difference maker. I wish they would have focused on someone who could have been a talent that could really be a major player.
There's zero star equity there. You're not getting a Devin Booker out of this pick.
Yeah. Although I think a lot of people would have said that you're not getting a Devin Booker out of the Devin Booker pick either.
But Booker at least was, he was, I believe, the youngest player in that draft.
That's right. Yeah.
And came from a place where it's known that a lot of guys don't get to show everything they can do while they're at Kentucky.
All right. Last guy I want to talk about here, Jarrett Culver. He's the guy that I was a little mystified with. You know, there is this kind of morass of wing prospects, and I had him towards the lower end of that group. I mean, I think his ball handling looked good, but I wasn't really buying his jump shot in college. He really lacks explosion getting to the basket. And I thought that defensively, he competes and he tries hard, but he kind of looked like he'd be more, you know, adequate than a difference maker on that end too. And so I was wondering why to take him at six for a Wolves team that, you know, in theory is not going to be drafting that high most of the time. Another pick where I just didn't really see the upside. Do you agree with me, or did you like that pick for them there?
I was a little bit in between the two poles on him, I think. He's a big wing who can handle the ball. So right away, bells start going off in your head that there's a chance here to be something that's hugely valuable. Does defend. His jump shot is definitely, I think, the swing skill for him. When you watched him, it didn't look that broken or bad or anything, but
I thought it just looked broken, actually.
It definitely didn't go in the net a whole lot. So that's...
I thought he was like shooting on the way down. He kind of had a hitch in it. I mean, you would probably know better than I do of like whether that particular flaw is fixable as opposed to, you know, the way Lonzo Ball shoots is fixable. But to me, I thought this guy does not look like a shooter to me from the college line even. And then you throw in the way he shot with like a big jump, kind of shooting on the way down. Those are the types of guys to me that have more trouble translating out to the 3-point line than the guys who kind of shoot more of a set shot.
Yeah, and the one thing with Culver is that we hardly saw him shoot threes off the catch because so much of that offense was predicated on him creating. Now, I can turn that around and say a lot of the real value for perimeter players in this league has become being able to shoot threes off the dribble, which he didn't really demonstrate an ability to do very well. But as when you start talking into different kinds of outcomes, can he be a secondary player? He needs to be able to shoot off the catch then. And we didn't really see any evidence for or against on that. It just wasn't an outcome we saw that much.
Yeah. And I mean, I think not seeing any evidence is a form of evidence in the other direction. I mean, you kind of think sometimes, all right, if somebody could be doing something, they would be doing it. I realized they had a lack of other threats on that team.
But no, there's a fair point there. Would they have run stuff for him off of pin downs or whatever if they had any faith in his ability to shoot off the catch? That's a fair point. He's big and he can handle the ball, and I don't know if he'll be great defensively, but he won't get lit.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about a big wing who can handle the ball. And I think if you are, and you know, maybe can't shoot that well, if you are really a top end guy, I agree with you. But I think that's actually something that teams can fall in love with a little bit too much. Like, he actually seemed a little Evan Turner-y to me. And Turner is kind of one of those same guys who, not a ton of athleticism, not a great judgment. I think his jumper will be better than Turner's, to be clear. Mm-hmm. But, you know, someone who has these ball handling skills, but then you're like, okay, is this guy really good enough that we're going to run a lot of stuff through him? Like, the NBA is kind of very regimented offensively a lot of times, to where, you know, you have the guys who are good and you have the guys who finish the plays that those guys set up for them. And if you're not good enough to really draw the defense's help and set up plays for others, and you can't finish plays either, then you're really kind of stuck in limbo. And that's somewhat of what I foresaw for him.
I think you make some good points about his low end outcomes. I guess I'm a little more bullish on what he is and what he can be. But I wasn't pie in the sky over him either. It's interesting. I guess I'm kind of neutral on him, and I'm really interested to see how this plays out for him in Minnesota and what direction he takes his career.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, if he learns to shoot, that's the way that I'm going to be wrong, right? I mean, that was my evaluation. His jump shot did look better when I saw him in person against the Warriors in preseason. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we'll get back, talk about some of the teams that John and I disagree on going into the season. All right, so I've been reading your fantastic season previews on The Athletic, also doing some really good mailbags that I've been enjoying as well. But we disagree on a number of teams, which is good. Your projections, I'm probably closer to the consensus on a lot of these in terms of, like, you know, the Vegas over-under maybe than you are, which I credit you for being willing to go out more on a limb. But the team I want to start with is the Warriors. You had them at 51-31 in your projections. I have them at 45 wins. Their over-under was 48.5. So we're kind of splitting the difference in either direction on them. Where I want to start with them is in something that your overall methodology for these projections was, you put in a replacement level for players on the idea that, as is true in 99% of all teams, if someone is just that bad, you can replace them with some freely available talent. The Warriors have so little flexibility that I think they could have multiple players that they're going to have to play who are not just replacement level, but below replacement level, because they can't even like move guys who aren't working out. Or if someone gets injured, you got to play like Alan Smilegeach or something. Like, he probably is worse than your replacement level, a guy out of the G League in a lot of cases. So and that's only part of the point, but just the lack of depth on this team. I believe in Draymond Green. I believe in Steph, but that's like, it's kind of all they've got right now.
Well, I look at it a little different. To me, they're going to have four good players out there to start the game, right? You got Steph, Russell, Green, and either Cauley-Stein or Looney, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Cauley-Stein and Looney are not making the All-Star game, but they're, you know, they're solid enough. You're going to have at least one pretty good big, whoever doesn't start among those two. Now, obviously, you're going to have some attrition during the year and guys will miss games with injuries or whatnot, but you still have most nights, probably, arguably the best offensive player in the league and arguably the best defensive player in the league. And I think the last couple of years were so easy for them that it was easy to forget how talented they could be when they were really locked in, because they just didn't have to lock in that much. And you could see it. I mean, there were so many games where they were just clearly kind of waiting around for whatever comes next, whether it's, you know, the playoffs, which it's hard when you're on a team that's that loaded and you kind of know in the back of your mind, you just have to kind of get to X number of wins and wait till the playoffs. And it's hard to dial up every night. And we saw that. I mean, we beat them in Memphis with teams that were massively less talented multiple times. And, yeah. It was entirely contingent on what kind of mood they were in that night. You know what I mean? Like, as proud as we were of our own team winning, we kind of knew that if they had really come to play, we probably wouldn't have.
Yeah. So I see that. I mean, and I'm a huge believer in Steph. I think their offense is going to be really good. Draymond, I agree with you in the playoffs. I think he might be the best playoff defender within a system with other good defenders. On this team, you know, I'd probably rather have a Rudy Gobert type or a Joel Embiid who can just hang back under the rim and at least control the paint, even if you're giving up stuff elsewhere. And I think that he is just, when he's not able to be in that switching system and they just don't have the personnel for that this year, then a lot of his value ends up going away. If he's not able to hide out on one of the weaker offensive threats and they have nobody else to guard a lot of these guys, right? Then he's got to actually just guard his man. He can't be as impactful as a help defender. So I think, you know, he obviously still really helps. He's also getting a little bit older. You know, he's been more effective in the postseason than the regular season the last couple of years. You know, maybe that's motivation. Maybe it's just he can't bring it for 82 games a year anymore and has some nagging injuries. So I'm really, really worried about their defense. What do you think they're going to rank in offense and defense? Like when you did that 51 win projection, what did you kind of have them at on either end?
You know what? I didn't break down the 30 teams that way. So I can't definitively answer that question. Yeah. There's definitely more offensive value on this team than defensive value. I don't think that's in dispute. I mean, Steph alone raises your offensive floor to such a high level, because you have to account for him in so many different ways so far from the basket that it just opens the floor to the point where everyone else is shooting the most wide open shots they've ever had in their life. And then when you add in, I mean, Russell, for whatever you think of him, is going to be able to take a lot of those possessions when Steph is out of the game, is going to be a threat to catch and shoot if you bring too much attention to Steph, and can be a threat on the weak side. So you're really talking about needing to fill in one spot with something just mediocre, like just give us something. Alec Burks, Glenn Robinson, like please. And if they can do that, I think they're going to be fine.
Yeah. I'm really worried about it starting the season with, you know, five NBA rotation caliber players, and two of them are centers, which, as we know, is one of the more devalued positions unless you've really got like a top end guy there. So, I'm really worried about it. I mean, I think their offense when Steph is on the floor is going to be awesome. I think they'll probably be a top five group when he's on the floor. When he's off the floor, especially when you look at some of those units that are going to be starting the second quarter, you know, Draymond probably will match his minutes with Steph. When Steph's off the floor, they'll probably be, you know, a bottom 10 unit, I think. I mean, if you look at that unit that started games in Brooklyn last year with D'Angelo Russell, once Caris LeVert was out, you know, where it was just him and there was a bunch of guys who could shoot. And those units, you know, were not really any good. Those were kind of 20th in the league type of units. And he's going to have less talent around him than he had in those units, because at least they had some shooting there. So, and those units are going to, whenever Draymond's off the floor, they're going to be awful defensively. They'll probably be, you know, playing defense at worst in the league type of levels when he's off the floor. So maybe Steve Kerr is going to be able to find some magic. We're going to learn a lot about Steve Kerr as a coach this year of like, can he really get a unit with below average defensive personnel to at least be passable? Or, you know, is he kind of really good coach for great talent and, you know, kind of average if he doesn't have that?
Steve Kerr and Rod Adams both, right?
Yeah. Well, Ron's got enough of a resume.
He has enough of a reputation, but now there's another challenge for him, right?
Yeah. And he's taking a little bit of a step back this year too, in terms of his role, kind of more of a player development type aspect. All right. Well, so that's Golden State. We'll see who ends up being right on that one. Portland, you had them with 41 wins. I had them with 46. Oh my God. They won 53 games a year ago. How the hell can you say they're going to win 41 games this year?
You know, it's interesting, setting aside my prediction for them. If you look at your prediction or Vegas or what Nate Silver has predicted for them, because Nate actually had them at 40 wins, I want to say.
Right.
They think they have an awesome team. Like, if you hear the quotes coming out of there, they think they're really good.
Neil O'Shea got a nice shot off at the projection systems. Like, Neil, I'm pretty sure your analytics department does those exact same kind of projections. So maybe calm down a little bit.
Well, the thing with me with Portland, probably the biggest part, I just don't see how they're going to be even. You talk about Golden State's defense. I mean, at least Golden State, the defense gets weak when you get into the backups. I mean, Portland, right at the start of the game, you're starting Lillard, CJ, and Rodney Hood on the perimeter with Zach Collins and Hassan Whiteside. I mean, if you have like a super motivated version of Hassan, I can see how that sort of works. But
yeah.
I just, by the second week of the season, you know, he's going to be reverting back to some of the things he did in Miami. And I think that's going to be a real issue there. The bench isn't very good.
His athleticism has waned a lot too with some of these nagging injuries. He's 30. You know, people kind of forget that because he broke in so late that he really is on the downside athletically. And, you know, he's not necessarily making up for it with his skill level.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the game keeps moving away from him too, especially at the offensive end.
Yeah.
Offensively, like Jusuf Nurkić was good. I mean, he did a lot of subtle stuff where he could short roll, he could make a decision in those if you trapped Lillard, and it would be good enough to make you think twice about it. And obviously he was a threat going to the basket too. You don't really trust Hassan in those situations, but he's not a three-point shooter either. He is a major lob threat and the offensive rebound threat, obviously. But if he tries to post up a lot, I think he's just getting in the way of Lillard and CJ. So that part's going to be really interesting. Like I said, the bench to me is a massive question mark. And I wonder too. I think they're going to end up having to start Kent Bazemore just to get a more defensive identity out there at the start of games. And then you bring Hood off the bench and let him score at that second group seems more natural to me. But right now it looks like they're going to start Hood.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for what Dame and CJ are able to do offensively. I mean, that's what a lot of this is. I mean, I think even for 46 wins for me, for a lot of Blazers fans, it is still like, you know, that's really low. But yeah, I do have some concerns of what the two bigs together to start is going to look like from a spacing perspective. But I think if they get units on the floor with Hood even at the three instead of a Mo Harkless or a Al-Farouq Aminu, that just having someone that defenses aren't going to leave there is going to be massive. And is Collins really that much worse of a shooter than either of those two guys? As long as they actually station him out there instead of like just having two bigs standing inside the arc all the time. Like I think that'll be, I think they'll be better offensively this year than they were last year.
Really? Although, they were number three in offense last year. I mean, there's a good offensive team last year.
Were they really that? I just think I had it in my head they're more like number five. Yeah, maybe not. Maybe that's being a little bit too rosy. I haven't projected as number five. So,
okay.
I guess maybe I was more thinking about what they were in the playoffs too.
Sure.
Without Nurkić.
Yeah.
I'm not counting on them getting a ton from him. They're talking about him coming back in like February and who knows what he's going to look like at that point. But I do think they have that more shooting on the wings, which would be nice. But yeah. And then defensively, they lost the wing defenders. There are some pretty good wings still in the West. That's a major problem. But I also am very curious to see, number one, you know, Terry Stotts' system, they've always been able to cobble together reasonable defenses, except for, you know, about a half year period before they traded Plumlee, by just really working the math and forcing teams to shoot in the mid range. And it's just, there's only so efficient you can be just controlling the paint, not forcing any turnovers. You know, you're not going to have a great defense that way, but maybe you can get by to pass well. And also just going with like two bigs who can actually block shots. Like, you know, we haven't seen those type of alignments very often. We're seeing more of them this year than we have in the last few years. But is that going to make enough of a difference to make up for the fact that they are smaller on the perimeter? I don't know the answer to that question.
How's Zach Collins going to block shots 25 feet from the basket? That's what I want to know. Yeah. Like, aren't you going to try to pull him out on every single play four out and make him a fourth perimeter defender?
Yeah, I think so. But those guys are still able to get in there at times and rebound and block shots. Yeah, I mean, it's going to reduce his effectiveness some, to be sure. But I think the research is generally showing, you correct me if I'm wrong here, that generally playing with two bigs, I mean, the Spurs have played with two bigs for a long time, right? And they've generally, other than last year, have kind of punched above their weight defensively, in part because of that, and just dealt with the consequences on the offensive end. So I'm interested to see if there's a similar effect here or not. It could well be that what you're saying is correct. I totally acknowledge that.
I mean, I think, you know, Collins is a big swing guy here, because I think one of the questions, are they playing with two bigs or are they playing with two fives, right? Yeah. I think those are two very different questions. And, we'll see what Collins can do. Certainly, I think matched up against Paul Millsap last year in that second round, I think that was favorable for him. But I think there are guys who shoot it well enough that it'll be a real problem for him on that end.
Yeah. And we'll see whether he plays some five as well. I still think that's his best position. He's got to actually stay on the floor too and not commit like four fouls every 20 minutes.
Well, that's the other factor. If he's having to chase more and play quicker guys, is he going to foul even more?
Yeah. Also, I think their offensive rebounding is probably going to be really good. Like, it usually is for them. It's been an underrated part of their success and Denver's success for that matter. But I think that, like, if they're going to play those two guys together, they should be able to really kill on the offensive glass. So both those guys are really good offensive rebounders. But we'll see. I mean, I definitely project them to take a step back. I have a little bit too much respect for Dame and CJ to say, 41 and 41, but I'm kind of taking the opposite tack here than I was with Golden State, I suppose. I'm not being entirely consistent, but we'll see. Also, the other thing too, I think Portland might be the most likely team to use a first round pick in a trade to try and
now get that better. I agree with you on, and they are in position. I think I wrote this up on The Athletic maybe a week or two ago, that they're in a great position relative to other teams in the West. It's them and the Nuggets as far as a star player being available and having the assets to put in a deal. When you have that huge Whiteside expiring, you have a couple of kids who are interesting for other teams. When you look at Collins, you look at Simons, you look at even Gary Trent, they have all their future first round picks. So they're in a position to put a deal together. However, I think the underestimated threat is that things could swing the other way on them too. Their early season schedule is very difficult. They are $12 million into the luxury tax. Right now they have the green light to spend, it seems like. But what happens if they're 13 and 19, 32 games into the season, and they're looking at a pretty large luxury tax bill? They have the highest payroll in the league right now. Is the owner going to cut the cord at that point and make them go the opposite direction and say, you know, you have to trade Kent Bazemore or something just to get us under the tax line?
Yeah. Well, and there's not a lot of ways to do that, because unlike in past years, we're not going into this season where there are teams that just, you know, like Sacramento last year, just are sitting around with 12 million in cap space. But also I think just because of the narrative of, oh my God, we got to the West Finals. We just extended Dame. We just extended CJ. We just extended Neil O'Shea. We've got all this great talent. We're really, you know, we're going to take the next step this year. We're not going to fall backwards. And also this history that they have of playing so much better in the second half after some rough starts. Mm-hmm. I think they probably just double down with this group, at least for this year. And then if it really doesn't work, maybe there's a reevaluation this summer. But it's difficult for me to see them punting entirely. I think they definitely chase the eighth seed because it would just be such a PR disaster. And we know that Neil likes his PR to just be totally out of the playoffs. And not only that, but just to give up in February, you know, as opposed to, hey, we just fought all the way. And
it would definitely feel like giving up if they made that deal, and they'd have some unhappy veterans. I do agree with that.
Okay. Sacramento, what did you have them for? 31 wins?
I had them with 30.
30. So 39 and 43 a year ago, pretty similar point differential to that. I have them with 42 wins. This might be our biggest difference.
Okay.
On the board here. I appreciate you only putting a little bit of skepticism into that. Okay. when you heard me say that, but my thinking was, I mean, this may be too reductive, was they won 39 a year ago. I didn't see anything incredibly fluky about what they did. Mm-hmm. Their young guys are going to get better. They got a lot of guys who you know, you may feel they're overpaid. I might agree, but they're NBA rotation players who fixed some of the holes that they had, including backup point guard. They got some good vets who can play defense that fit pretty well with what they're doing. So if they're 39 a year ago, everything points to them being better. Why are they going to be 9 wins worse instead?
Well, they might have an actual injury this year, for one.
Yeah.
I mean, you go through the games played last year. It's ridiculous. I mean, Buddy Hield, 82. De'Aaron Fox, 81. Cauley Stein, 81. Bielitsa, 77. Bogdanovich was out for a little bit. He only played 70. But, you know, those are their best players. I mean, the one guy who was out was Bagley. And honestly, that might have helped them, right? The way he played in the beginning of the year. So
he's a concern for me. Like, is he actually good? Does he really contribute to winning basketball? Like, he seems penciled in for 30 minutes a night. So that's kind of maybe where this could go wrong for me.
Yeah. I think there was always this question, even when we were scouting him in the draft, is he going to be an empty calories guy who gets 20 tens, but gives up so much defensively that he's kind of Greg Monroe-ish, or is he, not that he's the same type of player because he's much more of a fast twitch athletic guy, or is he going to be able to develop a 3-point shot, develop the ability to guard in space and become really a plus asset? And, you know, last year, I think, still left a lot of question marks on that front. Now he's still incredibly young. And his speed, I think that's the one thing that I think when they were good was when they could play fast. And so Bagley is able to play fast, and he might be able to replace some of what Cauley Stein gave him on that front. Because, I mean, one of the things that they did really well was that Cauley Stein was so fast in transition that when he beats your center down the court, now you're scrambling over and having a guard has to pick him up in transition. And that's how Buddy Hield was getting all those transition threes, or a lot of them, was because his guy was sinking back to take away the dunk. So now you're giving away the open three instead.
Yeah. I mean, I think Luke Walton is going to make sure that they play as fast as they did last year under Dave Yeager. That must have been hilarious to you, by the way, to see Dave Yeager screaming himself hoarse from telling them to run last year.
A little bit of a system shock, certainly after the way we played under him in Memphis. But
although in fairness, that was your personnel at the time.
Exactly. No, I do think he was he was agnostic about that. He just felt like that was how the talent had to play. The area where he was probably less sort of inclined to change was opening up with the 3-point shooting, which he actually did some in Sacramento last year too.
Yeah.
But in terms of pace of play, because you remember, like, he came out of the CBA and the D-League, like, there were some real Wild West kind of games going on there. So he's not unfamiliar with that style.
Yeah. So also, I think you might be lower on Dwayne Dedmon than me. I actually really liked Dedmon. I had him as, kind of in the low teens when I did my center rankings last year, because someone who can shoot, who can roll to the rim and can play passable defense, block some shots, like, that level of versatility is good. I like his fit with Bagley. And so I think having that ability to stretch the floor in particular, you know, assuming his shooting the last couple of years with the Hawks was real, which I think it probably is. I like that fit. You know, I think the way you termed it was they signed a bunch of backups to, like, close to starter money. And I don't feel that way about Devin. I agree with you on Ariza, who I don't really see how he fits in, and Corey Joseph. But, you know, what else were they using the money for? They filled their biggest need. So and they didn't go more than 2 years on these contracts, guaranteed, one in the case of Ariza. So I actually didn't mind those signings, because I didn't think there was a huge opportunity cost for them.
Wouldn't you have preferred they had done the Aguadala trade?
Well, yeah, I mean, to some degree, but, like, not everyone can do the Iguodala trade. Like, the reason they got that such a good deal, Memphis, was because there is no one else out there to do it, right? I like, if there were more teams out there to do it, then the deal doesn't become as good.
Yeah, well, that is a fair point. But one of the reasons Sacramento wasn't there to do it was because they paid Corey Joseph and Trevor Ariza when they, you know, like, are you really that much worse if you do a minimum with Raul Neto? Like,
well, yeah,
I mean,
I think Rashawn Holmes and Ariza, maybe I could have done with.
Yeah.
You know, those are the ones maybe that I look at. Holmes was the rim exception. So again, not a ton of opportunity cost there. And they're not going to have cap space very likely next summer. All right. That was fun. Let's take another quick break here. And we're going to do our mailbag, Twitter mailbag. Thanks to everyone who submitted questions there. And then we kind of come up with a good segment for this John story time. Really get into some of his experience with the Grizzlies. We're already looping that in, obviously. But specific questions that I have this whole list of questions that I want to ask him that we talked about on the trailer. So we'll be back in a sec here. All right. You want to hit some of these questions? Anything of particular interest to you here?
From Doc O'Carter, what are your opinions on the mid-range shot? I saw the back and forth with KD on Twitter, and he made some great points. According to analytics, it's not the best shot, but if you're good at mid-rangers, then that's a great shot. So this, to me, is a really interesting topic, and it gets into the debate that everyone got into with Zach LaVine this week as well. And the issue is that most of the guys who are good at mid-range shooting are also good at three-point shooting and therefore are leaving money on the table by taking a two-point shot when they could be taking a three-point shot. You see this so much with James Harden, where he beats somebody, but then he quickly steps behind the line to get the extra point out of it. You see other players doing that too. Rather than shot fake and step forward into a two, they're stepping sideways into a three. And if they can't get that, they're trying to get all the way to the rim and not shoot that 30 to 40% shot from the mid-range. Now, there's no question that being able to convert from the mid-range is valuable, because sometimes that is the only shot available. If the defense does their job well enough, you're going to end up with a mid-range shot. And sometimes, especially for the best players in mismatch situations, they can convert that too at a high enough clip. I'm thinking about Kawhi Leonard in the playoffs here, for instance, that you're essentially forced to double them, even though they're taking what is theoretically a bad shot. If you don't have the right defender on them, they can get into that shot so easily and shoot it at enough of a percentage that it still really puts you at a disadvantage. So I see that element to it, but there are still a lot of players who essentially don't see it at that level, and so are taking twos that didn't need to be taken because they could have been threes or they could have been rim shots pretty easily.
Yeah, I'll echo that. And I think what I can add too, Seth Partnow has written a lot about this, your colleague at The Athletic, that we've kind of gotten rid of the most inefficient mid-rangers, because it used to be that guys would spot up for mid-rangers. And number one, that was only worth 2 points instead of three at a pretty similar percentage. And number two, those guys were standing way closer to everything else and mucking up the spacing for everyone else. So just to even get that spot up mid-range too was screwing everything up for your teammates. Now, the biggest changes that we've seen is that guys who are spotting up, who are finishing plays, those guys are outside the arc. And so that's been the biggest change that I think a lot of people are missing. Whereas, of course, you know, a lot of the analysts who do talk about this are stars. A lot of the stars drive the conversation. And so they're like, I'm really good at creating my own mid-rangers. Like, that has a place. And as you talked about, I think it really does. But it's really for the role players that you shouldn't be taking any mid-rangers at all, basically, because you're compromising the spacing and the payoff isn't really worth it in any event. But for on-ball guys, you know, I think it depends on who it is, right? Like for DeMar DeRozan, he's never really shown the ability to shoot the three-pointer for whatever reason. Maybe he hasn't worked on it, but he's not effective out there. So most of the teams he's on, they need him to create some offense, especially late in the clock. So the mid-ranger is not too bad for him. You probably also maybe got a little bit better a chance of getting fouled if you get inside the arc or shoot a floater or something. Although, as you and I have talked about back when you were working for the Grizzlies, that three-shot foul is just a ridiculously high payoff. But for LaVine, he gets that three-pointer off so easily. He shot 37% last year on some pretty difficult attempts. I think if he took his mid-rangers and made them threes, I don't think his attempts would be much more difficult than the threes he's already taken. And apparently, the coaching staff talked to him about this, and he doesn't like it. But that's one where you're good at shooting threes, so shoot more if you can get them. You don't have to take as many twos, where he's kind of settling for more of those. And the hope too is, you know, he was their only creator. They didn't have much spacing last year. Now he can kind of get that shoot the three or get to the rim dichotomy a little bit more, because they will have some spacing around him.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's crazy that we're having this discussion regarding him, because for his career, he shoots threes better than mid-range twos, like even setting aside the extra point. It's also crazy that we're talking about him, because the one time that a mid-range shot is just as valuable as a three and you really don't mind is at the end of a one-point game, when last year he waved off his coach and decided to shoot a step-back three in that exact situation. The other thing, as you point out with him, now that there's a lot more floor spacing on that Chicago team, who I think is going to be a lot better this year, when you talk about having Otto Porter, Satoransky, Markkanen, Wendell Carter, is that instead of pulling up from mid-range, he can put pressure on the rim and draw and kick and generate a three-point shot for somebody else, which is the other thing that you see a guy like James Harden do when he gets that half step. The thing that immediately clicks in his head is, even if I can't get a dunk or a three, I can get it for somebody else just by taking that extra dribble to the basket.
Zach Barnes asks, got your protractor ready. I was always more of a compass guy, really. I figured, you know, if there's an apocalypse or something, a lot more useful to really defend yourself.
I'm a little miffed that he didn't ask about our pocket squares like Reggie Miller did.
Pocket protectors, right?
No, he meant pocket protectors, I'm sure, but he said pocket squares.
All right, here's a real question. Daniel Ravid, I think I'm going to either Ravid or Ravid. Does a team need to have good passers to have good ball movement? And it was the Clippers that were the inspiration for that. What do you think?
Well, I think we're confusing the means with the end, right? The end game is to have a good offense, not to have good ball movement. And I think we become so religious about the idea of ball movement being good and not ball movement being bad that we're forgetting that if you have good one-on-one scorers, often your best move is to not pass the ball at all and just let them go. I mean, that's one of the things that Houston has really mastered is that they actually don't throw a lot of passes. They just have one brilliant guy who has the ball in his hands the whole time. And then he makes the decision for everyone else and they just have to catch and fire, basically. So I don't necessarily think it's contingent on having a bunch of great individual passers to have a good offense, especially when you have the one-on-one talent that Clipper team has. I don't think it's going to look like the Spurs beautiful game team from 6 years ago, though. Like that's just not how they're going to play. There is going to be a lot of one-on-one with this Clippers team.
Yeah, I think that good passing is most important when you don't necessarily have that player. That's what lets you punch above your weight. And that's what made those Golden State teams obviously so ridiculous was you had to guard all of their really difficult system stuff. Even if you were switching, they had counters to that. They had really good spacing with their best lines. And then, okay, you switch, you stay in front of them. You're not getting an open shot through the action and the gravity and all the running around. All right, well, we'll just, run a pick and roll with Steph Curry and Draymond Green or Steph Curry and Kevin Durant. And you're not gonna be able to stop that either. And even Steve Kerr, who is, you know, maybe one of the biggest proponents of ball movement, has said, hey, you know, when you really get into the playoffs, when you're being scouted, sometimes you really have to just rely on your individual creators. So for a team like the Clippers, yeah, I don't think it matters that much. For a team like Orlando or something like that, where you don't have those great individual creators, then I think it matters more. You got to get the defense going from side to side. You have to give, I think part of it to me, why I like ball movement so much, is every possession, you should give the defense a chance to make a mistake. And, you know, even if you can get four backdoor cuts a game or something like that, you know, that's the difference between a terrible offense and a decent offense. You know, so you want to at least give yourself the option for the defense to screw up before you go into your, okay, save us, Kawhi, type of thing.
That's true. But one of the things we found, I think having a team in Memphis that was, let's say, rarely in the top half of the league in offensive efficiency, is that sometimes there's a cost to that in terms of having too many secondary people handling the ball too often.
Yeah. Turn it over.
When you take the ball out of your best player's hands. And that can lead to mistakes too. So there's a little bit of a yin and a yang with that, which is, I mean, it's one of the things that makes basketball so wonderful, is that you have to maximize the system for the talent you have. And it's different everywhere. And it's different every night, almost, depending on who's available.
All right. Where do you want to go next, sir? Should we address the elephant in the room here with Gasterman?
Where's that? Oh, yeah, we can tackle that. Okay.
What does John think about PER now versus back when it was conceived? It's a very widely used catch-all among fans. Is that good or bad?
Well, I, for one, think it's wonderful that it's a widely used catch-all amongst fans. Well, what's the argument here? No, seriously, having a single index, I think, is really helpful in a sport like basketball where you don't have where you don't have some of the stats like baseball. Like baseball always had batting average, ERA, slugging percentage, on base, where you were really able to compare apples to apples among players, and basketball never had that. And that was one of the reasons I created PER in the first place. And so still having that available, I think, is really helpful. Obviously there are blind spots to PER just because of what was available at the time and what's still not available. I mean, defense is still a little bit of a black box even now, but it does make good use of what is available. And I think the scale of it is pretty easy to understand when you say somebody has a PER of 20 versus a PER of 15. There's enough of a standard there that you at least know in your head what that might signify.
I always liked it because, yeah, I mean, it definitely was the state of the art, I think, at the time, also adjusted for pace, which wasn't being done back then. But I think it's useful in that you just have to understand what it's measuring. It's measuring, rather than just saying, okay, this guy averages 23 points and 15 rebounds and 3 assists, you can kind of put all of that together. I think it reliably summarizes the contributions of the box score, and that's like a good starting point. There are many things that the box score doesn't measure, and as long as we know what those are, it can still be useful. So, I mean, certainly if a guy has over a 25 PER, you're gonna have to have a pretty good argument of why this guy isn't good, and those non-box score factors to say that that's
absolutely the one thing inaccurate, that's, you know? That's happened in the 20 years since I created this is that the scale has gotten a little out of whack for the bigs versus the wing players, just because of the way the game has changed a little bit. And so that's probably the one element that you have to consider it a little more in light of what a guy's position is and his impact on spacing offensively than maybe you used to.
All right, let's do one more here. Sam Bart, as a Knicks fan, is there anything I can look forward to? Like, seriously, anything at all?
Whew. I mean, there's always the free agent hype for the next year when you're the Knicks, right?
Well, yeah, 2021 plan.
And literally every good visiting player that comes to town for the Knicks this year is asked about joining the Knicks in free agency, right? And so there's always that, but they're not going to actually come. So I think you got to say, I mean, RJ Barrett is their best chance at having a real centerpiece superstar on this team since they drafted Porzingis, right? So that has to be where you start. And what can he be, you know, watching him develop this year? He's obviously going to have the ball in his hands a ton. Is he, you know, which direction is he going to go in terms of, you know, developing some of his ability to be a distributor? Or is he just going to have those moments like he had at Duke last year where he's just kind of putting his head down and being more of a pig? And that's going to be a real question that I want to know the answer to if I'm a Knicks fan. And look, there's some other interesting young players this year. I mean, Brazdeikis was good in summer league. You know, they've Mitchell Robinson certainly is a talented shot blocker, is, you know, kind of wild and undisciplined as he is. I mean, he definitely shown ability. There's some things there. I thought the Elfrid Payton signing was actually a nice move. So, you know,
you and I disagree on him. You noted that you thought he made progress last year in New Orleans. I can't say once AD wasn't playing that I watched them incredibly closely. What did you see from him last year?
He had a triple-double. Come on, man. And with that haircut now, he can actually see the rim.
Yeah, maybe that was really, really holding him back.
No, I don't want to get too carried away. I just thought there was a little bit more of a solidness to him that I hadn't seen in Orlando. And it's tough, you're right, because, I mean, some of these games in March are such garbage that it's tough to take too much of an evaluation, take it too seriously.
Yeah, especially when you don't watch them like I do.
you were probably better off for that too, but I just thought there was something a little bit more solid, more composed there than I had seen.
Back to the Knicks, I wasn't too high on RJ. I don't think he's quite that athletic. I don't think his shooting is going to come around. I think there's a ceiling on him because of those two things. I do like his passing. I do like his rebounding. But I think that they are putting him in the exact wrong place to try and succeed with this group that they put around him.
You mean on the Knicks spacing. Or?
Yeah. Well, and with the personnel around it too. I mean, that's really a concern that they don't have a ton of spacing. They got a lot of other pigs, as you so eloquently
put it. He'd almost be better off with Luke Kornet than with Julius Randle, right?
Yeah, maybe so. Randle's a stretch
guy around him that can, you know, because he's that floor is going to be so tight in New York next year. I don't mean to imply in any way, shape, or form that Kornet is better than Randle, but I'm just saying situationally for what Barrett is facing, you'd almost rather have more stretching, or you definitely, I think, would rather have more stretchiness in that capability in half-court situations. And you're not going to have it with Randle there and with point guards, whether it's Payton or – I know I just talked up Elfrid Payton, but I still think you're leaving him pretty willingly to guard other players. So between him and Smith, there's not really that deep threat. So just a lot of questions about how that team is built.
I agree with you. Let's do this segment here. We would love some suggestions for this segment where I asked John some specific questions that I had about how things work in front offices. I suggested Holly's Follies. That was roundly shouted down. So if you guys could do better than that, we'll come up with a name for this segment. But for now, I'll just ask you the question. This time of year, you're making your end of roster decisions, trying to decide who to cut. You probably got some guaranteed guys, some non-guaranteed guys. How does that decision get made? Who has input? How much input does the coaching staff has? I'll just wind you up here. Tell me what that process is like this time of year.
It's a really interesting process because it can go a couple different ways. Okay, so let's say you're in a situation where you have fewer than the maximum number of guys guaranteed, and you just invite a few guys to camp thinking you'll cut them. Inevitably, one of them is going to make an impression on the coaches, and they're going to want to keep them. That is 100% guaranteed to happen. So you're always going to have that situation if you don't have 15 guarantees. You also can end up in situations where even if you have those guarantees, there's a guy the coach just isn't feeling, and he sort of sees some other guy there as a way to get that guy out almost. and so that's just the reality of it. And that's something, that you have to deal with too. Then there's the other situation, which Memphis is facing this year and which we faced a couple years ago, where you have more than 15 guarantees and really have to sit down and make a decision. And what's interesting from the coach's perspective, you know, they have a small sample and a small view into this, but there's an element of this that they can really control in terms of how they distribute minutes in the preseason games, how they distribute assignments in terms of first team, second team, third team, and practices. So they're able to load the dice to a certain extent. It just comes down. I mean, it's a real, you know, every team deals with this a little differently, but it comes down to a lot of times just to some really squishy criteria, because you're generally dealing with guys who are not established stars in the league, right? When you're talking about your 14th, 15th roster spot, and these are decisions that could basically go either way most of the time.
It seems like this decision coaches would really have more of an impact on it than, you know, a free agent signing in the off season. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I would, especially when you get into roster battles with fringe players. A lot of times it's easier to make the call in the coach's direction because you know that's the guy he's actually going to trust in a game and play. So unless you have some overriding reason not to go that way, that's where the momentum is going to go. By the time I was done in Memphis, the thing I'd really come to believe is that just have 15 guarantees. Just go in before one ball is thrown up. Just got to tell the coach, these are the 15 guys, and that's just what it's going to be. And go in like that. And then you don't have to deal with anything in the preseason. If he likes a guy, I'm sorry. We can maybe keep him on two-way or something, but that's just what it is. And I think that gets rid of a lot of potential situations and eliminates the possibility for a lot of things that, even though they're low-level moves, you still might end up regretting.
Yeah, and this guy is 6 of 15 from 3 in 4 preseason games.
Oh, small sample 3-point shooting. You know? Yeah, that's a favorite of mine.
So that touches on another aspect of this, which is, let's say you've got a guy who's guaranteed, you know, let's say maybe he was last year's second round pick that you took 42nd overall. You gave him a 2-year guaranteed deal. I guess you ran into this with Roddy Zagoric, who I think you guys cut.
We really painted ourselves into a corner that year because we had 17 guarantees. We got down to 16, but we had Mario Chalmers on a camp deal too. And, you know, in retrospect, you don't sign a veteran to a camp deal like that if you have too many guarantees already, because it's just too hard once the momentum starts for the guy to stop that train. And so that forced our hand too. We ended up cutting Rade and Wade Baldwin that year. I do give Chris Wallace credit. It took some pretty big stones to cut a first round draft pick the year after he had been picked, and I think it was probably the right move. I think the evidence has shown that. So it was unfortunate, but I also think we forced our own hand when we signed Chalmers to that partial, right? And he ended up not having a great year for us. We didn't need to do that.
Yeah, so I mean, was that difficult with ownership to be like, hey, you know, we got this guy who's partially guaranteed, non-guaranteed. We want to keep him. Guess what? Like, just because we cut these guys, they're guaranteed. You're still going to have to pay him. Now that's $2 million in cash, $3 million in cash that you got to spend for guys who aren't on the team. How hard is that conversation to have with ownership?
Well, I think it varies by the team and by the owner. And I will say Chris had that conversation, not me. So maybe I'm, you know, maybe I'm downplaying a little bit, but, for whatever reason, that conversation wasn't that hard because we had at least outlined what some of the possibilities might be before we got into camp. So it wasn't like something that we sprung on everybody right before Halloween. So internally, we knew what some of the possibilities were.
Yeah. I mean, I remember even back when I was a lawyer and I had clients and you might have a negative outcome. The advice always was, hey, just make sure when you start off, they're prepared for this. It's not going to like come out of nowhere of like, oh, wait, really? Seriously? Like, I got to pay $3 million more that I wasn't planning on all of a sudden, and I got to decide by tomorrow. You know, like that's the situation you don't want to be in. I do think that there are some teams, again, this depends on ownership. Dallas did this a few years ago where they basically just like, I think they guaranteed maybe like 18 or 19 guys. You know, they're in a situation where they'd used all their cap space. They weren't close to the tax. So they're just like, hey, you know what? Like, let's get the best possible guys in camp that we like. If we got a guarantee of money, that's fine. We cut them. It costs us money, but that's fine. You know, we got the best 15 guys that we could, but that's not realistic for every team, it seems like.
Yeah. I mean, just the cap implications of that for starters aren't workable for most teams in most situations. And then telling your owner ahead of time, we are definitely going to eat $3 million right here. I think that's a tough conversation too. But they were in a situation that, yeah, I remember that. They ended up cutting a couple guys with guarantees, if I remember right. Houston has done that too, where they cut Reggie Williams with either a half or a full guarantee and one other guy that year, 3 or 4 years ago.
Slightly different ownership in Houston at that time.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure we'd see them doing that move today. But that, you know, that isn't necessarily the worst way to do it if everyone knows what the score is coming in. I think in any of these situations, like you talked about, there's a lot of just managing expectations and having conversations and making sure everyone understands what is happening ahead of time.
All right. Well, thanks. This has been a lot of fun. We're actually going to do what might be my favorite segment, which is where John actually has to end the show in a cogent and concise way. So please take it away here, John. Tell everyone that they need to know and everything they need to do before we get going here.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to our maiden episode. I hope we entertained you. And you can find us wherever you find podcasts online, whether that's iTunes or Spotify or wherever else you can find us, and on the Locked On Network as well. And I'm sure I left out 3 or 4 other alternatives that Nate will tell you all about.
Well, please share on social media as well. It's definitely really important as we're trying to get a podcast off the ground, and give us a rating or review on iTunes. That's always appreciated as well. And we'll be back. Usually Sunday nights is going to be our time for recording. And that was pretty good, by the way, John. I still actually suck at that, like after 4.5 years of podcasting. And if you listen to some of my outros, it was pretty ugly in the beginning. So, all right. Thanks again for listening. And we'll be back next week. Till then.
How's that?
Okay, that's good. Here, talk about how Virginia is the greatest team ever real quick.
Virginia is the greatest team ever, Nate. And you really need to understand that. And I don't get why you would go to Tulane instead of Virginia.
Yeah, thank you. give me like another turn down. Where are you at in terms of like o'clock on your...
9 o'clock or 3 o'clock, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, 9 o'clock, like pointing towards the left there. Yeah, so give me like 8:30.
Okay, how's that?
All right, I think that'll be good. I'll just, you know, if you could just be totally dispassionate for the rest of the show, actually, that would be
that'll be great entertainment, I'm sure.